Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Visit one of our 44 stores across Ireland for quality curtains and bedding at great prices. Find your perfect style today.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Brace yourself for another horrific story, unfortunately, of crime in the capital as it happens at the weekend. Conal, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
Tell us what happened.
We were down here, city centre, North City Centre, and we have a bunch of American Airbnb guests staying with us for the weekend.
Okay.
Women, all women. They're there Friday, checked in Friday, Saturday night. We get a text message on to the house manager going, there's a man who's broken into the garden area, got into the kitchen, and the girls, the American girls, all barricaded themselves into the bedroom.
Wow.
And so this chap balaclavaed up this individual, nothing to take, and he turns around and grabs the TV off the wall. Mm-hmm. Slices it off with a knife. The girls are terrified, the Americans. Yeah. And then tries to get out the door he came in, goes through a plate glass window, puts a fire extinguisher through it to get out. Eventually realizes it's not the door, goes through the door, out on the roof and away.
And what time did all this unfold?
Beg your pardon, Joe?
What time did this unfold? That kind of
half twelve Saturday night. The girls are all sitting in watching telly. They were watching telly till it was ripped off the wall.
And you say five minutes walk from this buyer on O'Connell Street.
Yeah. We're very close to Guyanese, Joe, down there.
Okay.
Hey, we specialise in Airbnb big groups and like these are like early season and big American women, and they like people like coming to the city centre, Joe. We give them time where to go, what to do. Show them the way, the local best places to drink. We're all usual stuff. And it's the last thing we needed this time of the year.
And what did the eight American women think was happening? Did they think it was just a robbery or a lunatic?
I guess they were totally traumatized. They barricaded themselves into the bedroom when they saw this guy coming in with a balaclava. Mm-hmm. This is like something out of a Mad Max movie, Joe. So the girls then are screaming, they're texting us, they ring the guards. The guards are on the way, my house manager rings me, I'm on the way. Mm-hmm. And the guards get there, and fortunately, the guys in the Morris Bar there, they came in, the staff is very close, and they came in, they showed the guards in, and they helped the girls out. The girls packed their bags immediately.
Oh, wow.
Traumatized. And then... head for the hills.
No, they left.
To somewhere else. They ran out of the place. No, they ran out of the place, Joe. So, obviously, we had to give them a full refund.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Full up, not to mention the damage, not to mention the locks, not to mention the hassle, the worry, not to mention the bad reviews we get off these people, not to mention the loss of earnings with the money we had to give back to these people. Now, in fairness, the guys in the pub, they welcomed the girls. They helped the girls through the process with the cops. The guards did a great job, of course, as always. Yeah. But they're under pressure down here, Joe.
Well, they're nearby as well. I know they're not in the station all the time, but they're in probably the busiest, Pier Street, the busiest police station, the Garda station in the country. When this guy landed in, was it obvious to the women that he had a knife?
I can't say for sure, Joe, because to get the TV, it's connected to the USB.
Yeah.
So he ripped it off and then realized there's a connection here. So he grabbed the nearest knife to him.
Okay.
The girls are screaming and locked and panicked at the stage. And there's other girls in another bedroom saw him through the window and they realized he had a knife. Panic stations again. So chaos ensued, Joe. So he cut the cord and then grabbed the TV out the bloody plate glass window, nearly killed himself in the process. And off he went.
Did he say anything?
No, not a word. Not a word.
Has it happened before or anything similar?
Look, a couple of years back, we had a lad come in on some American tourist again, a young family. Now, we got him because he came back again a couple of weeks later, so we got him anyway. But Look, we're here 8 years, Joe. We've had a couple of bad ins. This is the worst, I think. You know, it's like, it's the brazenness of someone coming in to a house where there's women there.
Eight people.
Ripping the TV off the wall, Joe. Now, if there had been lads there, which certainly would have been more than possible, like, the hammers of hell would have rained down in the sky. I mean, he obviously is off his head, God love him. On whatever class A, whatever he's doing, he's obviously not in the right frame of mind, Joe.
So you're saying he went after he grabbed the telly and the women had barricaded themselves in the bedrooms.
Yeah.
He then headed for what he thought was the door.
Yes, yes. He went, he tried to get out what he thought the door he came in, but it was happened to be a plate glass. It looked like the door, but it was a solid glass. So he realised he couldn't open that, so he took a fire extinguisher to it and started to cave it in. When that wasn't, you know, he wrecked a window, double glazed panel, and then realised that's not the door. I'm going through the wrong exit. So he opens the actual door, TV under arm, up the stairs, off he went, hopped on the roof.
And what floor was he on?
This is all ground floor, Joe.
So he's ground
after
floor,
coming, okay. You know, we're sort of garden area down here, do you know?
Okay. Any CCTV?
We had some in the back. We didn't have any on the back and on the roofs at the back, Joe. It's not like we don't consider ourselves like Fort Knox or, you know, and a CCTV only goes too far. Do you know what I mean? Even if you did get them in CCTV, it's practically now impossible to recognise them. And once they're balaclavaed up, Joe, you need to be CSI and, you know, you're not going to get them.
And you had a balaclava.
Yeah, look, the girls are terrified. And like it seems just insane that the people ripping TVs off the wall, people looking at them screaming, women. So I just don't understand the.
Okay, you landed down. Had the Gardaí arrived at that stage?
Yeah, like the Gardaí. Well, Charlie from the Morris was in, and they're very close to where the Airbnb. Comforted them, gave them all a pint of Guinness, and with best Guinness in town, by the way. And off they went. God love them. They went to the nearest hotel they can get into. They ran out the door.
And had they been in Ireland before, Conal, do you know?
That I don't know, Joe.
Like, will they be in Ireland again?
Look, we do our best, and like we gave them the money back, and we did whatever we could, and you know, the random attack, we tried to mitigate it in whatever way, shape we could to make us as oh my God, this has never happened to us, you know, which actually has happened. But anyway, I hope they're not listening, by the way. Look, we did our best, and we give them money back. We apologise profusely. We try and do everything we can to mitigate the fallout with the American tourists. God almighty, Joe.
Oh, we're coming up to St. Patrick's Day. It's going to be a big
look,
one.
Look, it's just a nightmare. It's just a nightmare. I don't know what's going on. And, the brazen, anyway.
Eight people. Did they take it differently? The shock of it.
I guess they were traumatised after. Yeah. They were just traumatised. They just wanted to get out of here. We specialise. This is what we do. It's a hostel Airbnb. We're good at what we do. We've been here 8 years. We're established. We've a really good track record. We just can't deal with people coming up in balaclavas, ripping TVs off the wall. It's just really, really difficult for us to keep going. You know what I mean? It's like, how do you mitigate that, Joe? How do you mitigate someone scaling a wall and ripping a TV off the walls, Joe?
By the way, there was a time back in the 60s and 70s and 80s when I was a probation officer where TVs were and VCRs and DVD players were worth stealing.
Sure.
I hope people understand what I'm saying. But these days, televisions are much, much cheaper comparatively. So this fellow was really...
This is 100 euros worth of gear, Joe. Yeah. I mean, he ripped the brackets off. You know, this guy's... You know, he's obviously off his head. He's a uniquely troubled individual.
Have you been talking to the
major problems? But
have you been talking to the women since?
Just by email and just refunds, Joe, and just saying, listen, and the priest that we get all the money back. So we're down thousands thousands of the damage. We've got to upgrade thousands on the security systems. Probably some more thousands on CCTV, which is useless. Yeah, so that's where we're at, Joe.
Do you sound more embarrassed than angry?
I'm usually sad, Joe.
Okay.
I'm Dublin born and bred. I've travelled extensively around the world, and I've seen a lot of stuff. And it's hard to make it in business, Joe, in this country. It's not easy. You've got the DCC rates, the shop rates. You've got to pay. They should be paying us to open up, Joe. It's, you know what I mean. They're actually charging rates, and it's banana stuff. Like we're like, not to mention the VAT, POA, PRSI. We're getting hammered everywhere, Joe.
And this new proposed tourist tax per head.
Look. If the tourist tax helped more cops in the beat, or more get a kiosk opened up, or you know. I've no problem. Like Venice, they did it successful. The millions of tourists there. It's five ahead. No one bats an eye. Okay. Fantastic. Dublin has it. We have an awful lot to offer. Just where we are right now, Joe, there's major issues. You've got like major issues in the city that people, and I'm not really sure.
And what are the major issues?
You talk about this day in and day out, Joe. This is a record on repeat. Like, and what you're listening to me is what people say to you every day. I don't need to say it, but I'm going to tell you if you want to hear what I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's a major, like, around where we are in the city centre, it's kind of a forgotten part of town because, like, there was an awful lot of accommodation, a tourist accommodation. It's not anymore. So there's, for whatever reasons, the B&Bs, the hostels, they don't take tourists in anymore. So there's a lack of, there's a sort of vacuum there. So you've got all different types of people, which is great, absolutely, but there's an element which is not great. And people are looking away.
Yeah.
So you've got like abuse, there's alcohol abuse, there's drug abuse, there's petty crime, there's rampant homelessness in the area. And it's just in a very concentrated, small part of the city, Joe, which is people have given up, and it's not fair. The local community is like desperate. It's unique to this part of town. If it happened in any part of the other city, Joe, there'd be war. There'd be sections of the street barricaded. Mm-hmm. We're out here, and it's just not right. It's not fair. This has happened since COVID, since O'Gorman brought in this thing. It's just gone to pot. And no one cares, Joe. Okay. No one cares.
Michael Parkinson contact. Michael, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
You want to compare, it's pursuant to the point that Colin's making as well. You live in London, but you recently walked through Dublin city centre. And what was your conclusion, so to speak?
That's what prompted me to write your show. I was so disappointed and so saddened to see, we walked from Fisbury down to McCollum Street down that way, and just coming onto McCollum Street, it looked so dark, seedy, menacing. The mental people we saw there, you know, there was a lot of beggars, and unfortunately, I just felt like a very hostile type of environment, you know, and I was just taken aback, really. It just felt how McCollum Street looked. I haven't been there for a long time, and it looked really. It just looked very dark and menacing, and it didn't feel safe. That's what myself and my wife, we just didn't feel safe walking down.
And it was down O'Connor Street you were going, that part, the north.
It was O'Connor Street initially, and I know, the city is bigger now and busier noisier, but it just. I was talking to your researcher. I mean, I just looked very menacing, you know, the amount of people in doorways, and, you know, and I feel sorry for, you know, these people. I was talking to your researcher. We looked across at the GPO, and it was all lit up, and I saw a whole line of people lying there, and I thought they were going into some sort of show or something wrong, and then I spoke to one of the street cleaners, and he said, no, this is the Friday soup kitchen, soup run, and... You know, it's sad. It's good that it's been highlighted, but it just gives an indication of how the city is, you know, that there's an undercurrent of, you know, homelessness and poverty and drugs and alcohol abuse. And and I think that feeds into some of this kind of aggression and violence. You know, it was very saddening to see it.
And what's the experience? Well, again, London is a different city and much more spread out.
Well, but I go in there. I live north outside of London, and okay. I go in regularly, and we win, and it's you know, I feel very safe. You can walk around. I mean, there are, you know, it's parks like North London, the states that you wouldn't go to, but you know, the tourist park, central London, you can go around there any time of the night there, and it's very safe. And there's always a police presence. You know, I noticed that now when I was at home. I didn't see that many guards about at all. You know, I think it's probably underfunded. But it's a safe place, and it's enjoyable. We couldn't wait to get out of the city, to be honest with you, you know.
Wow.
We went around by Grafton Street, at the bottom of Grafton Street, and there used to be a shop there that used to sell pipes and tobacco and cigar shop.
But it's still
gone now.
But I think it's moved around the corner into this Captain Peterson. Yeah, it's a great store.
I just noticed there was a bookies at the beginning of the street, and I was thinking, well, you know, I've essentially researched the amount of gambling and, you know, the shops, you know, bookies around the place now. It doesn't give a good image to the city, does it, really, you know? It doesn't. And, it was just very saddening to see how the city is going.
Brenda Power in today's Daily Mail makes the point, one, it'll take years to sort out Dublin, but also she makes the point that every city has its no-go areas and every city has its do-go areas, if you follow me.
Yeah, but generally speaking, the likes of, you know, Oxford Street, all the main streets, you know, you can walk down there safely and feel, you know, don't feel, you know, so, you know, you have, like any city, you have to have a wits about you. But I just got this sense of aggressiveness among people. Especially some of the younger people, I thought, they were hoodies and things. They just seemed more aggressive.
I come
from Ballyfermot. I know what aggression is like, you know, and originally from Ballyfermot. And so it's not as though I don't know what aggression, gangs are like, but it seems a lot worse now than it was in my day.
Okay.
By the way, we went to the same school, Joe.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Next John, St. John.
Oh, St. John's, yeah. It's a great school.
Yeah.
Great school. Okay, Michael, good to meet you. That's Michael Parkinson. And thanks for contacting us, Michael, and kind regards to you and your family. Joe at RTE.ie.
On 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I don't know if people in Ireland are as worried and conscious of how unwell Pope Francis is. If you're to go by international media and indeed the Italian media, Politico, which has a European base and a North American base, their headline this morning is Pope Francis, sensing he is close to death, moves to protect his legacy. I want to talk to John McCord, who's a rector of the Italian University. But I presume you're from Ireland, are you, John, at some stage?
I am indeed, Joe. Okay. Yeah, I'm from Dublin.
Good to hear from you. John, is it fair to say, is Italy worried about the health of the Pope?
I think Italy's very worried about the health of the Pope. I mean, he's 88.
Yeah.
He's clearly struggling. You know, he has health issue after health issue. He tends to struggle at this time of the year, the winter. Because he's a very hard worker, so he's always out and about, and, you know, saying, doing the Angelus in the open air and saying his masses in the open air, and he seems to go from one kind of chest infection to another. So this time he seems to be struggling a lot, and as he says himself about himself, he's kind of stubborn. He won't agree to rest when he perhaps should at his age.
So when we read a headline, Pope Francis sensing he is close to death, moves to protect his legacy. But that jumped out at me. As a bit melodramatic.
At 88, going on one lung, I think it's realistic. I mean, he might be good for another few years. I wouldn't write him off by any stretch. Okay. But I mean, I think it's entirely natural that he would be thinking about what's going to happen afterwards.
And then we have the whole brouhaha around Conclave, the movie and the book by Robert Harris originally. Is there...
100%, yeah.
Is there... There's hardly ruminations among the College of Cardinals already, is there?
Oh, of course there are. The College of Cardinals love this. Of course they do. So there's, you know, you see a list of possible front runners appearing in the on the Sunday papers here. I mean, and as we know, it's very rare that a front runner goes in. You go in as the would-be Pope and you come out as a Cardinal. So it's worth the paper it's written on. Not worth very much, probably. But yeah, they are talking about the future. I mean, he has packed the College of Cardinals with, you know, a lot of people who are in his own, who are in his own image, you know, very human, inclusive kind of Pope, you know, very you know, relaxed kind of an approach to how he deals with people, unlike previous popes, a bit less formal, let's put it that way. So I suppose, and who've been a bit more inclusive in terms of, I mean, I know not everyone appreciates what he's done for example, for women in the church. People think it isn't enough, but he has, through gestures, tried to work against the, you know, the big body of the church, the which is unmoving. I mean, the actual Vatican itself, whereas the church itself, the people of God, are probably way ahead of them, you know.
Is it premature to say, like, the College of Cardinals? I know you have to, if you're over 85, you can't vote for a start. Is the College of Cardinals very different to the one that elected him and the previous before that?
I'm not an expert, Joe, but I think they are quite different. I think he's chosen a lot of people who are would not have been chosen by his predecessors. Absolutely, he's chosen various people from religious orders. He's chosen, it's a much less European-centered College of Cardinals. There are fewer Italian cardinals. It's much more representative of, I think, of the Universal Church. So it's quite different.
And will, for example, he's spoken out strongly against the policies of Donald Trump, President Trump. Will a new cardinal be leaning in that direction as being much more outspoken about the events in the world, like migration, for example?
Yeah, it's a tough one for a pope to, you know, not enter into too much direct politics, as you know. And his letter to the American bishops was unusual, I think. But then again, what's going on in the United States is, to put it mildly, unusual. I mean, he's always shown support for refugees and for migrants, and he's always underlined the fact that, you know, the whole story at the center of Christianity, Jesus Christ and all of that, and his family being migrants and, you know, being expelled from their land and all of that. So he sees that as part of the Christian story, and, you know, he defends that, if you like, that's part of what he believes. And whether who comes after him will follow in that line, I suspect increasingly so, because we're living in a world which is putting up walls rather than building bridges and, you know, not joining the dots. We've got climate change, which is driving people to leave in droves from various places, and we're sending them all back. We're sending them back from Italy. We're increasingly in Germany. It looks like they're going down the same road, and not to mention the United States. So the Christian message is one of hospitality and acceptance, and, you know, with all the limits, obviously, it's very difficult. It's not easy. I get that. And Ireland has done a huge amount in terms of refugees and all of that in recent times. But despite the difficulties, I think his message is that we have to keep doing that. That's the Christian thing to do.
And in his letter to the American bishops, he said, "I exhort all the faithful of the Catholic Church and all men and women of goodwill not to give in to the narratives that discriminate against and cause unnecessary suffering to our migrant and refugee brothers and sisters. With charity and clarity, we are all called to live in solidarity and fraternity, to build bridges that build us ever closer together, to avoid walls of ignominy, and to learn to give our lives as Jesus Christ gave his for the salvation of all." That's pretty strong stuff.
Well, it's very strong stuff, but he has a great direct way of saying things. I mean, if you go back to 2015 with his encyclical, No, Laudato Si, all about climate crisis and environmental degradation and all of that. I mean, he was extremely clear there. I mean, at a time when the world summits and the political summits were coming up with stuff that was not that easy to interpret. His positions are extremely clear, and they're all about taking responsibility for the planet and for the poorest on the planet and those who suffer from environmental issues. It was a very strong message at the time. It's still very strong today, even though increasingly we struggle to actually hear it. But I think that's one of the things about this Pope. He's very direct. I mean, I was lucky enough to be at an audience in 2023 that he had. There was a conference on global, the Catholic imagination, let's call it that.
And, okay.
He had a prepared speech, or a speech prepared for him by somebody, and he threw it down and said, you don't want to listen to me reading a speech. And he just spoke off the cuff about the importance of art, the importance of literature, and articulating, you know, in articulating the human condition, calling on artists and filmmakers. Martin Scorsese was among them that day, telling them to keep, you know, giving testimony to the complications, mm-hmm. the complexities of human life. And it was that direct way where occasionally, of course, he slips and says something he shouldn't say, and then he gets hauled over the coals for it. But that capacity to just, you know, ad lib off the cuff is one of his great qualities, I think, at least. He has that in his way of communicating in a way that other popes before him perhaps didn't have.
Okay, stay with us, John. Kate, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Are you worried about the Pope, given what we're now reading and hearing directly from Italy through John there?
Well, yes and no. I think from what they're saying, he's okay. He's had a pretty bad bout of bronchitis and things, and he is only has one lung and all that. But he's kind of fairly tough, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And keeps going. Of course, as your other speaker said, he's 88.
John,
he's fragile. So I suppose we just have to be prepared, as no doubt he is. I'm sure he's very well prepared to meet his maker.
Well, that was the headline I read out. The headline I read out was Pope Francis, sensing he is close to death, moves to protect his legacy. Now, whether that's just a generic, or if you're 88... Some people live much longer now. Well, a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Would you pray for him, Kate? Okay, that's Kate gone. Sorry. Bridget Stain. Bridget, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay, Pope Francis. He's worried about... Sorry, he moves to protect his legacy. What do you think will be his legacy?
Well, certainly, following the two previous popes, he certainly came across as a very person who liked other people,
mm-hmm.
who tried to meet people, who definitely tried to live out the example of this poverty and simplicity. You know, he didn't go around and mm-hmm. get chauffeur driven. Absolutely, he was tops on that, tops on the environment. I don't think his legacy will be seen as being liberal, because I don't think he has the scope. He is allowed the scope. Mm. He would be allowed scope to be liberal. You know, he might like to change something. I think there would be a lot of resistance in the Curia. And that is something that I suppose every Pope meets with.
Yeah, but he seems to. Well, John, you believe he has made an impression.
Oh, I think he has. I think it's been very tough, but in because he's been working against the Curia at times, not with the Curia, and he's, you know, there's some extremely conservative people in there who've done their best to rein him in. But I think he's never to be underestimated. I also think he'll come through this illness, by the way, because I think he is tough. But okay. He has a lot of miles on the clock, as you say. You know, he's had a long and very complicated life, difficult life. And,
I wonder, John, was he disappointed in his visit to Ireland in 2018? Like, it was a bit of a damp squib. The Phoenix Park was definitely a damp squib. And notwithstanding the faithful who turned out on what was a horrific weather day and logistics that were almost impenetrable, people were walking from Nace, it seems, to the Phoenix Park, such was the cordon. But I just wonder, compared to the reception John Paul got in 79 in the same location, I just wonder, was he cast down after that trip to Ireland? Now, I know he did. He met victims, and that seemed to take up a lot of the time, and survivors of abuse. But I often wondered, was he cast down by that? Comparatively.
Well, I think the Pope, Yeah, I doubt it. I think he looks around the world and sees the church in decline in places like Ireland, which it clearly is in huge trouble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the church has, you know, a lot to answer for there, undoubtedly. But then he was off the following year in Indonesia, for example, mm-hmm. and had a hugely successful yeah. trip. So, you know, I think the church take a very long-term view on these things. So, yeah, it was certainly not a very successful visit. It was astonishing, really, if you compare it to where what it would have been 20 or 30 years earlier. And it just signals a complete low point, I suppose, for the church. But I suppose these things come around, and I doubt very much he was that surprised, because he'd be well kept yeah. informed, I presume, by the Irish bishops and, yeah. and who would be coming through Rome on a regular basis.
Okay.
He doesn't seem like one who's easily, you know, discouraged. You couldn't survive in that job if you were.
Okay, 51551 Joe at RT Daddy. Kate, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
You're very positive about Pope Francis. Were you there when he visited Ireland in 2018 in August?
I didn't go to the park. Okay. I couldn't manage it, but it was certainly a big contrast, but I think he's a pretty realistic man and he'd be very well briefed. And, you know, Ireland is a very different place to mm-hmm. what it was then.
Yeah, of course.
My God, it sure is. So and I think he'd be aware of that.
Are you positive, and long may he live, are you positive about Pope Francis?
Do you mean in general or
yes,
in health?
Yeah, no, in general.
Oh, in general, yes, very much so. Very much so. I think he has brought a breath of fresh air to the papacy and to his role and to the church. Because his mm-hmm. initiative, this thing about synodality,
is a
bit of a terrible word, but it's all about participation and listening. Mm-hmm. And if that, even a tenth of what he had hoped for, gets through, I think that would be very positive for the church. And, you know, I think around the world, people are trying. And certainly there's been an effort I live in Dublin, so there's been a fair effort in Dublin Diocese to follow through on it. And, you know, so I think that's pretty good. And I think he has, as a person, I think he's been very, he's been attractive and, you know, simple things that he has done, like he doesn't live in the papal apartment. He decided to live in this sort of communal place that visitors stay in. And he eats his meals at the table with a whole lot of other people and so on. And that's pretty revolutionary for the Pope in recent times. Things like if you've been in Rome, you might have noticed, if you're observant, that there are these sort of clerical tailors around the place.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the Pope, until recently, until Pope Francis, had special red shoes made,
The shoes of the fishermen.
Francis said, no thanks. My own old black shoes are grand. And he wears his black shoes.
But is that not all optics, Kate?
Sorry?
Is that not all optics?
Well,
is that not like saying I live on the average industrial wage rather than being taking the TD salary, pardon the analogy?
Well, no, the thing about it is he's not saying anything. He's just doing. And I think he doesn't go boasting about these things at all. But it's just that by choosing to live that way, he is allowing himself to be closer to people. Now, of course, where he lives, I think, is pretty clerical, but still better than in a kind of an ivory tower of an apartment. You know, they're small things, Joe, but I think we give ourselves away a lot by small things.
Okay, good point.
Well, and
actually, very well put, actually. Kate, did you see the movie Conclave, this one that's winning all?
Unfortunately, I haven't made it yet. I read the book, though.
Yeah, the book was excellent by Robert Harris.
It was a really good read, I recommend it highly.
Do you... do you, for example, do you follow papal politics? Have you any idea who the next pope might be?
Well, no, obviously. Okay. But well, I mean, there is a mention I've heard, where I've read or whatever about there's a Filipino cardinal called Tagle.
Oh yeah.
Who was the Archbishop of Manila, and I think he's now in Rome. And he's a very
he's supposed to be very progressive, wasn't he? The social justice.
I think he's progressive, yeah. And he's well, you know, he's like maybe like Pope Francis himself, forward-looking and but not overly progressive. You know, wouldn't be would be fairly. It's do you know, you could say again, it's style, but I think it's substance as well. That they are measured in their progressiveness.
Okay, stay with
you know, I suppose you'd love for them to gallop along, but you know that if they did, they'd lose a lot of people. So
yeah, it was not a tightrope. Stay with us, Kate. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. The New York Times on Saturday, which I happen to be reading, had an obituary for a young Irish woman called Eleanor Maguire. When I saw the name, obviously I had a view that it might be Irish, but Eleanor Maguire, it turns out, has died at the young age of 54. She was buried in early January. From Dublin, her parents Anne and Paddy still based in Dublin, predeceased by her brother Declan. But Eleanor Maguire, it now emerges, was a remarkable individual, a remarkable neuroscientist, a cognitive neuroscientist, and a remarkable character. And which prompted us to, because we did it about a month ago, 2 months ago, Irish women who for some reason, and Eleanor is only recently deceased, unfortunately, but for some reason have been forgotten. And it's taken the New York Times to shake me into, and other people into, realising who this, and asking, who is this remarkable woman? And Professor Shane O'Mara is Professor of Experimental Brain Research Psychology in Trinity, and he's on WhatsApp at the moment. Good afternoon, Shane.
Hiya, Joe. How are things?
What? No, it's the wrong way to go at it, but why did the passing, so young, 54 years of age, of this incredible neuroscientist, why did it virtually go unremarked, as far as I can see, in Ireland?
I don't have a good answer for you there, Joe, is the honest truth. It didn't go unremarked within the neuroscience community here or internationally. News of it went around the world very, very quickly. And to be honest, there was great sadness and shock at her passing at such a young age. And she did feature in various obituaries. I know she was in The Guardian and various other places done extended obituaries of her.
The New York Times, that's right. Picked it up.
Yeah, but I don't think it was especially noticed here in Ireland, apart from within the kind of relevant community, which I hope we'll get a chance to redress a little in the next few minutes.
And tell us about Eleanor Maguire.
Yeah, so Eleanor is from Rochestown Avenue in Dublin. She did psychology in UCD, and then after this is back in the late 80s, early 90s, then went to Swansea and did an MSc in neuropsychology, which is the study of people with brain damage.
Okay.
And then she came back and did a PhD under Teresa Burke, who was at UCD at the time. And they did a remarkable piece of work on people who had surgery to a particular part of the brain known as the hippocampal formation. Typically, this would happen after somebody might have epilepsy that doesn't respond to drug treatment. Wow. And what she found was that these people had grave difficulties in orienting themselves in space. So they didn't have a what you might call a cognitive map of the world. It was a beautiful piece of work for the time. She then subsequently won a fellowship from the Wellcome Trust and went to London and did amazing things funded by the Wellcome Trust over the next 30 years.
And tell us about this. Well, you got to know her in the 90s. She would have been born in, she would have been born 1970. She was only 54 when she passed.
That's right.
And then this, which was really highlighted in the New York Times, this incredible study. Well, first of all, the idea of it, of studying London taxi drivers and the brain, the hippocampus. Yeah.
So she had a really, well, she had a kind of a love-hate relationship, I think, with that study. She had a really interesting moment of insight watching a program about taxi drivers and the training that they do over a long period of time. So reflecting back on the work she had done on her PhD, showing that the hippocampal formation was needed to learn about where you are in space, she thought, well, if this is true, maybe we can pick up a change in the brain related to people who have learned the 15 or 20,000 streets that there are in London. Yeah. So what she did was recruit taxi drivers.
Because taxi drivers in London, I remember seeing the black and white Pathé News. Yeah. The taxi drivers in London, I don't know if they still have to do it, have to do a thing called the knowledge. Which is from their memory, they're asked, take me from Paddington Station to Holborn Station. The quickest route, and then if they explain to the examiner what route they would take, and it's just a phenomenal amount. So Eleanor spotted this and said,
let's take these drivers who take 3 to 4 years to learn the routes and compare them with bus drivers who follow a fixed route.
Okay.
And what she found was an early example of what we now refer to as brain plasticity, that the rearmost part of the hippocampal formation was larger in the taxi drivers and was greater in volume compared related to the amount of time that you spent on the road. So the kind of claim that she was able to make reasonably strongly was that the brain was changing because of experience.
Wow.
And that experience affected not the brain as a whole, but a particular part of the brain that was concerned with doing a particular thing. In this case, organizing your spatial knowledge of the world, how you find your way around in the world.
And how did she go about? Did she wire up taxi drivers and wire up non-taxi drivers and try and spot the difference in terms of the activity in the brain?
So a bit more subtle than that, actually, but not far off. This was at the start of what's called the brain imaging revolution. So she was able to use MRI scans of the brain. And so she recruited taxi drivers, she recruited bus drivers, and she was able to make the comparisons between the bus drivers and the taxi drivers. And this difference was clear. It was obvious, and it was one that fell out on inspection from the MRI scans. So it's not an obvious thing to do, but it actually answers lots of questions about how training affects the brain. Does it make a difference to what goes on in particular brain regions? How much training you need in order to have those effects come out? And it also explains a mystery, which is, why is it that people who suffer, in particular from dementias that affect this part of the brain, are lost in time and space? It's because this brain structure is key to understanding your orientation in time and space.
Which is an incredible revelation in the world we now live in.
Yeah, isn't absolutely. It? Yeah.
And that's brain plasticity.
Yes, absolutely.
Does that mean there's parts of the brain that you can take to the gym, basically,
That's a great analogy, actually. And the answer to that is yes. Use it or lose it, train it, and you'll continue to win with it.
And it also proves. I'm told she had a great sense of humour, because I watched her funeral service over the weekend when I came across her name on RIP. And that came across. She loved stand-up comedians. Seemed to have a great sense of humour. But she did prove.
No, she was great.
She did prove that travel broadens the mind for certain London taxi drivers, at least.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, I think the ironic thing is she'll always be remembered for that taxi study, and correctly so. But The work she went on to do afterwards, I think, is really much more interesting in many ways and much more profound. Would you believe one of her students, Demis Hassabis, won the Nobel Prize a few years ago, not for his work on the things that she had been doing or he had been doing with her, but she had a very good eye for talent and for developing talent. As you said, she was very witty. It was always a pleasure to have dinner with her or whatever. She was very, very amusing and full of life and joie de vivre, as it were.
And what you mentioned, that there's other stuff she should be remembered for apart from the
So she did something really interesting and not obvious, which I think helped us understand again lots of the things that go wrong in dementia. So she took a group of these patients that have damage to this part of the brain from a viral infection, so that they basically had destruction of it. And she asked an unusual question. She asked, instead of can they remember the past, she asked, can they think about the future? And what she found was that these amnesic patients can't imagine the future. That, in fact, what they do is they live in a perpetual present, and they're not able, they can't imagine the world as it is now being different to the world as it is now. So they can't plan holidays next year. The details they'll give you about what they're thinking about in the future are very, very limited. And they're very kind of focused on what they can see and experience in the moment. It's not like their thoughts or their minds are empty of thought. It's just that their thoughts are driven not by abstractions about what I'm going to do next week or the next year or whatever. They're very, very much driven about, well, I'm making a cup of tea at the moment, so I'm thinking about the switch that I have to press on the kettle. And, you know, it's a very kind of, as she put it in the paper, stimulus bound. And I think that opened up a phrase that we use commonly in the literature, which is mental time travel, which is the ability to flick forwards and backwards in your mind. I'm going to do this next year. I did that last year. I'm doing this at the moment. And that's denied this group of patients. And her work shows that it actually results from activity in this part of the brain, which is the same part of the brain that the taxi drivers have in large volume in.
We're talking about the late, and it's horrific even saying it that way because she was so young, the late Eleanor Maguire from Dublin, died in early January, not too long ago, obviously, at 54 years of age, who was regarded, as we're hearing from Shane, and I'll read out other testimonies, as one of the world's leading cognitive neuroscientists. And I'm quoting from, if I can find it now, Chris Frith, Emeritus Professor of Neuropsychology at University College London, described her as, Eleanor changed our understanding of memory, and I think she also gave us important new ways of studying it. All this done before she was in her early 50s.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely remarkable person. And she was given lots of honours, really sought them. Yeah. So she was elected as a member of the Royal Society in the UK, which is the oldest scientific society in the world.
Big accolade,
yeah. And she was elected as a member of the Academy of Medical Sciences. And I had the honour a couple of years ago of introducing her as an honorary member of the Royal Irish Academy.
Oh, brilliant.
Which she was elected to as well.
Brilliant. She had a sense of humour. Even though she studied the taxi drivers and came across this brilliant angle, so to speak, which added to our understanding of the brain. She said, I'm absolutely appalling at finding my own way around.
Her joke was that she was perpetually lost.
Okay. Stay with us, please, Shane. We're talking about the late, and it sounds like a cliche, but it doesn't, and I want to say it beside her name because her name, I suspect, was unknown to so many fellow Dubliners and fellow Irish people, Eleanor Maguire, the late, great Eleanor Maguire.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We're remembering Eleanor Maguire, a cognitive neuroscientist, a young Irish woman who died on the 4th of January, and it's and a lot of people knew this, as the fellow said, but a lot of our fellow countrymen and women didn't, that she was one of the world's leading cognitive neuroscientists. Shane is still there. She was into these, which people are fascinated, these memory athletes.
She did, this is something that people are perpetually fascinated by, hyperamnesia is the name that's sometimes given to it, but people are fascinated by them, and there are people who practice so-called mnemonic techniques to become better at remembering. And I think one of the interesting things that came out of that work was that there's nothing abnormal or weird about these people, other than the fact that they practice techniques to allow them to remember things better. The old technique was the memory palace technique, and she again showed that there was nothing unusual about the hippocampus in those patients.
So any of us could become memory athletes.
I think that is true.
If we concentrate and have the time.
It comes down to the issue of strategy, where paying attention where memory is concerned, and in particular, practicing pulling information back out of memory. Don't spend so much time thinking about how to get it in there. Spend much, much more time getting whatever the material is out and getting that elaborated into all sorts of new knowledge structures. So, you know, when you're learning a new language, don't spend lots of time learning the words. Practice using the words in lots of different contexts. So that's the general advice where that's concerned.
Apparently she was a Crystal Palace fan as well.
I'm not a soccer fan, so I can't comment on it.
She loves stand-up. We're getting messages. She loves stand-up comedians. She's always cheerful, always good company, very private person. She was, as she said herself, she was very small. She was 5 foot. Great success in her. Is it wrong to say, Shane, a relatively short career, given that she passed at age 54 and had been... Though I heard at the funeral service when I watched it on RIP that she was involved in research right up to the weeks before she passed.
If she hadn't been struck down, she would have continued on for decades to come. Her career was cut off halfway through is probably the way to think of it.
And her obituary remarks that she was diagnosed with spinal cancer in 2022, and over Christmas developed pneumonia. Shane, to finish, how should we remember this remarkable woman?
Sometimes there are great people walking around who've done remarkable things, they're not, you know, we overlook them because there's the hubbub of all of the other things that are going on. But she, you know, did some absolutely fundamental work tying different aspects of cognitive function together. Memory, everyday thinking, imagination, thinking about the future, and showing how these were all tied together in a common set of brain structures. Using really advanced technologies, she changed how we thought about things, and I think that's really the kind of the key variable. You know, a scientist wants to leave behind a legacy that says people think things differently because of the work that I did. And I should say the other thing about her was she was tremendously careful as a scientist. She didn't, publish big papers just to get noticed. She would take an awful long time sweating over the details of things to make sure that she got everything right. You know, so a model of scientific integrity as well.
Given that the Young Scientist Competition is 50 years old this year, I wonder, did she ever enter it?
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, well, God rest her. And thank you for remembering her so vividly, Shane, and condolences to you. And obviously, Eleanor's family, Paddy and Anne, predeceased by her brother Declan, and her nephew Senan, and Alton and her sister-in-law, her aunts, uncles and cousins were all mentioned in the obituary notice. Remembering, Professor Shane O'Mara was remembering the late, great Eleanor Maguire.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Back to the incredible crime story we heard at the start. Dublin, last Saturday night, eight American tourists in their accommodation. And a man in a balaclava basically broke into the accommodation just before midnight on Saturday night. The two groups of women barricaded themselves. He had a knife into their two bedrooms. And this guy, one, ripped the television off the wall using the knife to cut, then proceeded to try and exit the building by walking through a plate glass window, which he realised he wasn't the door, and then he made good his escape. Brenda, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You're retired Garda, likewise. Yes. What happened, Brenda? This was about 6 months ago.
It was, yeah. When I actually was listening to you earlier, I just felt I had to make known what happened to me. Even as a Garda, and I've seen much in my life and my career. I got off the loose at the top of O'Connell Street at Parnell Street East. Okay. And you walk across then, we'll say, to the front of the rotunda where there's a railing, and also you pass by the side of the ambassador. So if you understand where I'm talking about.
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah, of course. Busy spot there. Now, a couple of new homes.
Very busy stop between the Lewis and a lot of people coming and going. And the actual footpath was busy because I thought to myself, gosh, it's busy. And I had two bags, one in each hand, and I was on the railing side.
Okay.
So it's a wide footpath there. But out of the corner of my eye, I saw a young man coming towards me. And what drew my attention to him was he's both his hands in a bomber-style jacket. So that's a short jacket with pockets that would be high. And they were sticking out. But, you're walking, you're not taking a lot of notice. And as he passed me, he hit me as hard as he could into the chest. That's where his elbow caught me.
Deliberately.
Oh, deliberately. I'd never set eyes on him in my life. Yeah. And he said some lurid thing to me as he walked. Now, why he picked me out, I have no idea. And I was obviously stunned and shocked because it did hurt. And I turned around to be very angry. I was going to scream at him.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd walked on a couple of steps. And as I turned around to say something to him, he'd also turned around. But in that split moment, I saw he was with others. And he came back at me. And I'll never forget the look in his face. He was so full of hatred. But I've seen this before. I was obviously cued enough to say, okay, turn around and walk the other way, which is exactly what I did as fast as I could. I don't know who saw me. People had to see what happened. But obviously, all you want to do is get out of there. And even now I'm shaking because an incident like that does leave a mark in you. And I just couldn't get my head around it. And all I thought was, okay, I can deal with this fairly well, I suppose. I'm still thinking about it. But I can deal with it. But what if it happens to a younger person, somebody more vulnerable? You know, what is the answer for
all this?
By the way,
Brenda, was he on his own?
No, that was the thing. He seemed to be, but when I turned around and he came back at me, I noticed he was with others.
Okay.
So I was certainly not taking them on.
Of course not. You're a boy. Stay there, Brenda. Kieran Murphy. Kieran, your observation, please. Crime.
Hi, Joe. When I heard that awful story about the eight American tourists, I just felt
I had to text in and just make a point or express my outrage. I guess over the last couple of years, I have seen the city deteriorate very sadly. There is a dreadful crime problem, a lot of it drug-related. There's open drug-taking, there's open drug-dealing. Mm-hmm. There's a huge litter problem. And to be honest, I'm not very proud of my city. In fact, I'm ashamed of my city. And I don't like to say that, but that's a fact. And, you know, I don't see this in other cities of a comparable size in Europe. And I've gone on many weekend breaks, you know, to all sorts of countries in Scandinavia and in Eastern Europe. And I don't see this. I see city centres which are designed to attract tourists and the local population to enjoy the amenities in a crime-free, you know, secure environment. And we definitely do not have that in Dublin. And I believe the whole system is sort of, it's almost biased against the guards and against, you know, proper security and justice. We need a COVID-type response, Joe, where all of the state agencies, the guards, the judiciary, the other authorities, that they work together. The guards and the judiciary often seem to work against each other, and that the guards bring in people after apprehending them, and then when they're put in front of a judge, they get either bail or they get and it takes a long time before they're actually, the case is heard, and then when the case is heard, they get a very lenient sentence or a small fine, and they're out in the street again. We just have to reverse that. We have to bias the system in favour of the victim, so that the victims get justice, and so that the criminals see this as a deterrent to committing crime, which is certainly not the case at the moment. I think the criminals are almost laughing at the guards and laughing at the judiciary and laughing at the rest of the population. Yes. We have to bear the brunt and the pain of their actions. And it's just not acceptable, Joe. And even going back to the schools, we need to, you know, gear the schools towards teaching students about the law, you know, to sort of ingrain a respect for the law at a very early age, a sense of civic duty, a sense of a respect for the public realm, so that we don't have the litter and the vandalism, which is endemic in Dublin, Joe. And unless you go around with your eyes closed, you can't but see it.
But still, I know what people are going to say, Grafton Street, when I say it, but still there are parts of Dublin that would have had a good reputation. But anyway, hopefully Brenda, come in. Sorry, you were a guard.
I would like to say we have to go back to the grassroots. It's as simple as this, Joe. We need a police presence, a visible police presence on the streets. I mean, I would speak to some colleagues from time to time and you hear it hasn't changed. Well, it should have changed because back when I was a guard, I was in community policing for quite a period of time. And that is the one thing you need. You need to gain the respect. Respect actually is the key word all around here. You need to gain the respect of all your communities, whether they're in the city or outside. And you then will have a better connection all around. And, you know, especially in the city centre, it's about feeling safe. And for those people who come into our country as well as ourselves, and like that man, I travel a lot. And I would honestly say, I too am ashamed to say.
And Brenda, have the Gardaí on the beat got enough powers when you stop somebody?
This is the question. Like, I, again, that man just gave the description of the revolving door. That is the system. But we must have. Of course, there are powers to stop and detain somebody, and if necessary, bring them to the station. But of course, you do. But then again, discretion is gone. Now, one time there was a little bit more discretion. You could leave somebody go, maybe, if you thought you'd give them a second chance or whatever. Everything now is a little tighter, and maybe for the good, who knows? But I think it has changed. Not for the best. Okay. And when I was out there, at least, you know, there was a lot more Gardaí present on the street. And it was, I would think, at least it felt and it was a safer place to be.
Okay,
that's right. Where it needs to be at the.
Well, I think those 9 million, that 9 million euros spent on the telephone pouches for second level schools, should have been spent on pouches for the Gardaí, so they, and give them the power to confiscate a mobile phone there and then under suspicion, and keep it for a week or two so it can be looked at. Simple thing that would annoy the guts out of the Gurriers.
It would.
Annoy the guts
one
out
thing,
of it.
Yeah.
Okay, Brenda, good to meet you, Margaret. Thank you. Good, Margaret, Brenda. The Vatican has cancelled the Pope's weekend commitments. The Vatican's now worried, given that this is, as you know, a jubilee year in Rome. And indeed, wasn't Donald Trump and Melania due to visit the Pope as a, in on account of that? And indeed, King Charles was due to go as well. Deacon Frank Brown is in Temple Ogan, Dublin. Frank, are you worried about Pope Francis?
I suppose, like your other callers, he's such an amazing person. I was there in the park.
Okay.
I mean, 130 people went to see him, but a million people watched it. I mean, RT's coverage was fantastic.
130,000.
I've read loads of things he's written. I think, in a way, most of us know Pope Francis has been in poor health, and most of us were praying that he'd get to the synod and he'd actually get to sign off on the synodal document. That's actually church teaching. There has to be lay people involved in the church. Women have to have a say in decision making. And he doesn't want a clerical church full of women. He wants a church where everyone can make these what's called synodal decisions together. I think the Pope can look at himself in the mirror and say, I've done a great job. And if he needs to rest or even retire, so be it. So I think, like other people, he's got this horrible lung problem that'll come and go. But his brain, like your lovely tribute to that neurologist was wonderful. The Pope works every day, and I imagine his mental state is perfect. And that's probably what allows him to do his job.
Okay, well said. Well said. That's Deacon Frank Brown, Gurumila Market, Apprentice. Neil McMonagall, broadcast coordinator, was Shane Galvin. Niall was on sound. Producer Annette Egan. Brendan Courtney is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Cozy up with the new arrivals, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.